Thank you. Well, this is not really about bioethics, though etymologically this is about biology a bit and about ethics, but it's not really bioethics as people ordinarily understand it. Now, it's sort of interesting that if you think about earlier liberal thought from the Enlightenment up through the 19th century, the idea of moral progress was pretty central to much of what was going on in liberal thought. But then it drops off the radar screen in the 20th century, at least explicitly. People don't talk about moral progress much in the liberal tradition, and there are probably a lot of good reasons for that. And these are some of the reasons why liberals are and perhaps should be wary about talking about moral progress. In the paper on which this talk is based, Russell Powell and I focus on this one because we think it's more philosophically interesting. And we think one of the main flaws of earlier ideas of moral progress was that they weren't sufficiently empirically based. They lacked, well, there were also these horrific problems. Often conceptual moral progress was based on an idea of morality or human excellence that was quite dubious. But apart from that, there was a conspicuous lack of good empirical support for the claim that moral progress, however they understood it, is feasible, for the claim that it's inevitable. And many of the theories claimed that moral progress was inevitable. They had a sort of iron laws of history, stages of civilization view. And also, they were not very good at explaining how whatever moral progress has already occurred did occur, nor did they tend to provide very plausible, empirically based accounts of how moral progress stalls or how regression occurs. So if you're trying to resurrect the idea of theory of moral progress, you need to avoid those flaws, or more positively, you need to be able to explain the feasibility of whatever kind of moral progress you're talking about, and you need to have an account of how it occurs and of what happens when it, why it doesn't occur, or why it stalls, or why there's regression. Now, our strategy in this paper is pretty unambitious. We don't try to provide a ground-up account of what moral progress is that would apply to a wide range of instances of things that we intuitively think are morally progressive. Instead, we focus on what we take that at least liberals will agree is one important instance of moral progress, namely a shift from almost exclusivist conceptions of morality, that is, roughly tribalistic, speciesist conceptions of morality that don't extend basic moral status very widely, to ones that are more inclusive. And we try to develop a naturalistic, that is, empirically grounded theory of this kind of moral progress, the conditions under which it occurs, why it occurs only under some conditions and is absent elsewhere, why there's regression, how that occurs. And we try to do this on the basis of the best available knowledge about human nature and society. And I think that people nowadays have something of an advantage over earlier theorists, because earlier theorists were handicapped in trying to provide an account of the empirical basis of moral progress, because they simply didn't know enough about human nature. They didn't know much, they didn't know anything about evolutionary psychology, and they didn't know as much about institutions as we know now. So the hope is that given that we know more now, we can have a chance of developing a theory of moral progress that avoids some of the flaws of the earlier versions. But how do we do it? Well, we rely on and integrate three things: the strongest evolutionary accounts of the emergence of morality in humans, empirical work on normal cognitive errors and biases, and what I call social moral epistemology. And the definition of that is parasitic on a more familiar definition of social epistemology. It's sort of roughly Alvin Goldman's definition with a little modification. Social moral epistemology focuses on beliefs that tend to be critical for the well-functioning of our moral powers, and especially on how social institutions and practices influence those beliefs. Now, Lecky, in his book, A History of European Morals, From Augustine to Charlemagne, it's a pretty ambitious of her book, talks about the idea of expanding the circle. He tends to view moral progress pretty much as a matter of expanding the circle of concern. And Peter Singer takes up that phrase from Lecky in the book and uses it for the title of the book, published in 2004. And what Singer tries to do is to show that moral progress, understood as expanding the circle, is possible in spite of what the sociobiologists were saying at that time. So roughly the idea is that expanding the circle of moral concern is extending moral standing, some sort of basic moral status, to all human beings and to some non-human animals, regardless of their group membership or strategic capacities, ability to harm or benefit us. That is, the expansion of the moral community, a class of beings that have some kind of moral standing, beyond tribal boundaries and beyond mutually beneficial cooperative relationships between groups. And alternatively, you can think of it as a rejection of restrictions on membership in the moral community based on gender, race, ethnicity, or species. Now, Singer has a very limited conception of moral progress. He just thinks it is expanding the circle. He doesn't recognize that there could be other kinds of moral progress. It's not surprising, given that he's a utilitarian, that's the way he thinks. And he explains, you might put explain here in scare quotes, the shift toward expanding the circle as being a matter of reason. That, well, I think that's right. It's just that we need to know what kind of reason, we need to know under what conditions that kind of reasoning is pervasive enough that it brings about a change in our moral responses in the direction of being more inclusive. He says that inclusivity goes against the evolutionary grain. He sort of tips his hat to the evolutionary biologist there, but he says that reasoning can overcome the disposition to exclusivity. But the big question is, what kind of reasoning? Well, in an earlier paper, which I was criticizing Phil Kitcher in his book, The Ethical Project, I floated a very awkward term, the capacity for open-ended normativity. It's the ability to identify the norms that we're following, subject them to some kind of critical evaluation, conceive of superior alternatives and internalize them, make them effective in our behavior, and even to become aware, criticize, and revise your conceptions of moral standing. This is a pretty sophisticated capacity. I mean, you can imagine people following norms but not really having the conception of a norm, not really being able to objectify the norms, to identify them, articulate them, much less criticize them. So the big question is, under what conditions is this capacity likely to be exercised by significant numbers of people in ways that foster moral progress? And again, we're going to focus mainly on one dimension of moral progress, this notion of overcoming these arbitrary, exclusionary constraints on who counts morally speaking. Now, I think Singer's book is helpful, but I think it's got some inadequacies. For one thing, greater inclusivity isn't always morally progressive. I mean, it doesn't always make things better, morally speaking. You think about fetishism defined in the original way, it's the projection onto inanimate or non-human objects, powers that they don't have, and then sort of submitting yourself to those powers. Getting away from that can be viewed as reducing one's conception of the universe of things that have moral standing or that are moral agents. And sometimes that's a good thing. Also, if you think that cosmopolitanism can sometimes go too far, if you think that some crude versions of cosmopolitanism overlook the importance of special moral ties, then you also might think that that's another case where greater inclusivity isn't always better. Some moral conceptions that are in some sense exclusive are appropriate, or that don't grant the same moral status to all the beings we might encounter, but that's a good thing. Now, quite apart from that, Singer just doesn't consider any other possibilities for what might count as moral progress, and we think that these are things that most of us would agree are cases of moral progress. What I call warranted demoralization, coming to regard as morally permissible, or even in some cases morally obligatory, actions and practices that were previously thought to be immoral per se, like masturbation, profit-seeking, questioning the authority of rulers, premarital sex, homosexuality. And then there's the reverse coin of that, warranted moralization, coming to regard as morally wrong or impermissible actions or practices that were previously mistakenly thought just to be permissible or morally neutral, or even in some cases, obligatory, like torture, cruelty of non-human animals, wife beating, vendetta, honor codes. I mean, in 18th century Paris, it was thought to be a really nice, wholesome family recreation to go watch public cat burnings. It was popular. About the same time, it was thought to be wholesome family recreation to take the family and go to Bedlam and look at the lunatics and make fun of the lunatics. Now, there are other types of moral progress. Improved conceptions of moral responsibility that take into account mental states and volition, not simply causation, and that abandon inappropriate conceptions of collective responsibility. More humane forms of punishment, improvements in how the virtues are understood, expansion of the conception of the domain of justice, to include the recognition that institutions are human creations. They're subject to ethical evaluation and modification. They're not just natural facts that have to be accepted. Let me just mention, if you think about types of moral progress, you might divide them initially something like this. On the one hand, there's just improvement in behavior, right? I mean, Steven Pinker, in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, draws on an extensive literature on homicide rates and cites a work which says that here in Oxford in 1350, the homicide rate was roughly 25 times higher than it was in 2008, which is the next time they had statistics. Now, I mean, I think that's a moral improvement, right? But it's not clear that it's a moral improvement that reflects some better moral understanding on the part of people in Oxford or better moral norms or concepts. There's a huge reduction in homicide rate in Europe from about 1450 on, and it looks like it's at least in part due to the establishment of the state, which claims a monopoly on coercion and the enforcement of the king's peace. And so it really might have not much to do with people sort of getting better attitudes toward their neighbors, at least not initially. It's just improvement in behavior. You can count that as moral progress, but it's quite different from moral progress in the sense of getting better norms or better conceptions of good moral standing or better understandings of justice or something like that. Now, here's another limitation of Singer's view. Now, we don't need to be beating up on Singer. We're just doing it to try to get clearer on what a theory of moral progress should do. Appealing to reasoning as, you know, how we expand the circle doesn't adequately explain what it should explain because of three things. First of all, there's the fact of limited penetrance. Distribution of inclusivist morality in a human population is both relatively recent, especially with things like regard for the welfare of non-human animals, and it's still very uneven. But there's no reason to believe that reasoning is a late development in human beings, or that reasoning is only found in those human beings that tend to have inclusive morality. So you got to say more about what kind of reasoning it is and what the conditions are under which that kind of reasoning is likely to produce this change in moral responses. You can't just say it's a matter of reasoning. And also, reasoning, notoriously, can be and is employed to justify exclusivity. So again, you've got to say more about what kind of reasoning promotes inclusivity, because you can't just wave your hand and say it's reasoning. And finally, it looks like the right sort of reasoning is prevalent and efficacious only in certain environments, but Singer doesn't tell us anything about that. We try to say something about that in the paper. Now, I said that one of the ingredients that goes into trying to provide a more empirically grounded account of moral progress is evolutionary psychology. And the way it comes in is that there's a large literature which gives a kind of simplified view about the evolutionary origins of human morality, and then draws the conclusion that given that that's our history, there are some rather severe constraints on what morality can be like among humans, and that in turn constrains the possibilities for moral progress. And here's the basic idea. human hunter-gatherer groups in the environment of evolutionary adaptation in the middle of the late Pleistocene evolved under ecological conditions that strongly favored exclusivist moralities and severely penalized inclusivist moral tendencies. What were the conditions? Well, these are the main conditions that people cite. Severe competition for resources among scattered, weakly genetically related groups, with levels of productivity sufficiently low that sharing resources with outgroups entailed dangerously high cost in terms of reproductive fitness. Absence of institutions and practices to facilitate peaceful, mutually beneficial cooperation among groups, in contrast to institutions and practices within groups that produce stable cooperation among group members, and high risk of infection by biological and social parasites. The biological parasite idea is pretty easy. If these groups are weakly related and genetically related and they're scattered, then each group is a virgin population for whatever infectious agents the other group has that it doesn't have. And so encountering people from another group can be literally lethal. What's social parasitism? Well, suppose you just sort of uncritically allow some out-group person to come into your group. They may destabilize your cooperation by being free riders, or they may just not get it. They don't understand the norms and they cause discoordination in that way. So that can be destructive as well. Now, the idea is that under those conditions, human morality was shaped in a certain way. The result of the selective pressures in an environment having those features was truncated forms of the moral emotions, especially sympathy, largely limiting the extension of sympathy to one's own group. Xenophobia and ethnocentrism, distrust of and lack of moral regard for out-group members, and all of that leading to significant limitations on the capacity for psychological and hence for behavior altruism. Now, I don't think there's a simple relationship between psychological altruism and altruistic behavior. I think that when you have the right institutions and social practices, you can economize on psychological altruism and still get altruistic behavior, behavior that mimics altruism. But in this environment, you don't have the institutions and practices that, as it were, extend your psychological altruism and its results. Now, what's evoconservatism? This is a term that Powell and I coined to cover a whole bunch of people from different disciplines who accept this simple picture of the evolutionary origins of human morality and then draw conservative, pessimistic conclusions about morality and politics. And we quote some of the people in a really extreme cases, Poser and Goldsmith in their book, The Limitations of International Law. They say, well, you know, here's the evolutionary story. Therefore, all this talk about human rights and cosmopolitan global institutions is just hot air because we're not capable of that kind of thing, right? We're people who are engineered for these sort of small groups. Well, what they don't explain is how we got the nation state, right? I mean, you know, there are 303 million Americans and a lot of them are willing to die for each other. They've never seen each other, et cetera. And if some sort of cooperation extends that far, why assume it can't extend any further? Now, the evoconservatives are kind of muddy as to exactly what they're saying about how pessimistic they are about all of this stuff. So we try to sort out several different views. The first one is the most extreme, that inclusivist morality is merely aspirational. You can talk about it, but it's not going to be behaviorally effective. It's not going to affect the way our institutions and practices work. Because human moral emotions such as love or sympathy are hardwired to be quite limited. A second weaker view is that even if somehow you get some movement toward inclusivity, it's not going to be durable because it goes against our grain. The strong exclusivist tendencies of evolved human moral responses will inevitably undermine whatever inclusivist developments have occurred. The third view is that inclusivist moral limits have already been reached. And the fourth is that efforts to realize inclusivist moral ideals will encounter serious resistance from our evolved inclusivist tendencies. Now, Powell and I are happy to endorse this, but in the paper we criticize the first three, we reject the first three. And most of that work is done in a paper that's about to come out in ethics called The Limitations of Evolutionary Explanations of Morality. What's wrong with the first thesis that, you know, inclusivist moral commitments are just aspirational? Well, I mean, think about it. Think about what's already going on for significant numbers of human beings. There is better treatment of non-human animals, or some non-human animals. And this is not just aspirational, it's actually changing the law and social practices in ways that are quite costly to us. Also, many people now regard many moral norms as universal, as not restricted to members of their race, gender, or ethnicity. And then there's the whole phenomenon of the modern human rights movement, which has been institutionalized to a large extent and has produced a radically new body of international law and transformed domestic law in many countries. And there's also what I call in a much earlier article, subject-centered morality. That is, it's a conception of moral status such that individuals can have moral status even if they don't have the strategic capacity to harm or benefit us. If you think of somebody who has the different conception of moral status, what you might call the mutual interest reciprocity view. Think of Gautier's book, Morals by Agreement, right? On his view, the idea of being a moral subject vis-a-vis somebody else is that we're capable of engaging in cooperation in some way. Well, this idea that that's all there is to moral standing goes way back. You find it in some utterances of Glaucon in Platonic Dialogues. You find it in Epicurus. You find a whiff of it in Hume. And it's basically the idea that we only confer moral status, and it only makes sense to confer moral status on beings that can either harm or benefit us. And I think we've moved away from that. Some of us have moved away from that. What's wrong with the second thesis? Well, because eco-conservatives don't really have any explanation of how we've gotten the inclusivist developments that we've gotten, they don't have a good account of why they're not likely to last. They might last or they might not, but we don't have any particular reason to think that they're not durable. And for the third thesis, well, for the same reasons, there's no reason to think that we've reached the end of the evolutionary leash, that we're not going to be able to make any further gains in inclusivity or with respect to the penetration of this idea across different populations. And we provide a richer explanation of how the biological underpinnings of morality interact with environmental and cultural factors, and that explanation doesn't give any reason to think that we're at the end of the story as far as inclusiveness developments go. In fact, our view actually provides, you'll see, some guidance for how you might achieve further progress. What's wrong with the fourth thesis? Nothing, as far as I can tell. It may be that because of our evolutionary history, at least under certain conditions, there's a kind of strong resistance against some forms of inclusivism. But not much follows from that. So there's the summary of the argument against the evo-conservatives. Now, one thing I'm not going to go into here, but in the first paper, we summarize it in the paper on which this is based, we say, look, you know, there are two basic kinds of evolutionary explanations of morality. There are selectionist explanations, and they divide into standard selectionist explanations and sexual selection explanations. And then there are byproduct explanations. And what we do is go through all of those alternatives and show that none of them can adequately account for the actual cases of inclusivity that already exist. Just as a kind of a hint of how that works, I mean, think about better treatment of non-human animals. It's hard to see how either in the environment of evolutionary adaptation or even much later, that would have been a subject of selection. That is, that it would have been conducive to reproductive fitness, and quite the contrary. In the original environment of evolutionary adaptation, it would have been disastrous. So what's our account like to try to remedy these deficiencies? We try to develop a richer account of the conditions under which inclusive plurality is likely to flourish. And the key is to try to eliminate the conditions that foster exclusivist morality and help create the conditions under which the inclusivist morality can flourish. Now, what are those conditions? Well, that's where the evolutionary story about the environment of ancestral adaptation is relevant, right? It tells you what the environment was like that fostered these exclusivist tendencies. And then, presumably, that gives you some reason, at least, to think that the further you get away from those conditions, the more space you have for the development of more inclusivist morality. That's the basic idea. And we advance four hypotheses about the environmental conditions that are relevant to the development of exclusivist or inclusivist morality, respectively. First is the luxury good hypothesis, that inclusivist morality is a luxury good. That is, it's only likely to be widespread and stable in favorable conditions, namely those in which the harsh conditions of the EEA have been overcome. Second, the subjectivity thesis, that inclusivist gains are likely to be eroded not only if those harsh conditions return, but if enough people think that they've returned. And third, the cognitive and social epistemology thesis, evolved cognitive biases combined with defective social epistemic practices can cause people to believe that the harsh conditions of the EEA are present when they don't exist, and hence can trigger these exclusivist responses. And finally, the self-fulfilling prophecy thesis, if enough people believe the harsh conditions exist, they'll act accordingly, and their acting accordingly will actually help bring about that they do exist. Now, we then rely on two well-confirmed empirical assumptions, namely that in-group, out-group biases are among the most cross-culturally robust of human psychological characteristics. Second, the development of exclusivist moral tendencies is sensitive to environmental cues of out-group threat, having to do with infectious diseases, expropriation of scarce resources by out-group people, and physical attacks by them, and also foreign beliefs, norms, or practices that are dissonant those in the in-group and thus threaten group cohesion or are believed to do so. These are all threat cues which can activate moral responses which were selected for in the environment of evolutionary adaptation. And these threat cues trigger negative moral emotions, fear, disgust, trust, anger, create dispositions toward aversive attitudes and behaviors toward out-groups. Conversely, negative responses to out-groups tend to be lessened in environments in which such threat cues are not present. And let me just say one thing about the threat cues. I mean, if you look at the kind of language that people use who try to motivate others to commit genocides, or the kind of language that was used by the eugenicists to try to encourage people to undertake programs of compulsory sterilization, or in the case of the Nazis, of so-called euthanasia, there's a striking preponderance of language that has to do with infectious disease and agents of infectious disease, parasites, rats, cockroaches, plague-carrying fleas and rats. Right? I remember Hitler's propaganda film, The Eternal Jew. It begins with a hatch of a ship opening and a swarm of rats are coming out. It's not an accident that these kind of language is used to try to mobilize extreme hatred and dehumanization, revoking moral status against out-group members. It's not an accident at all. It's explained given this account of the evolutionary origins of these kinds of attitudes. So here's an important interim conclusion. Exclusive morality is not hardwired. Everybody says it's hardwired. It's literally not hardwired in the sense of being a constant tendency present under all circumstances. Instead, it's a conditionally expressed trait that only develops under specific environmental circumstances. It's not the default mode. People seem to think it's the default mode. There's no reason to believe that. Instead, it's much more likely that it's an adaptively plastic trait. It's triggered when threat cues are present, but may not be manifested at all when they're not present. In fact, there's actually a good evolutionary reason why it would be an adaptively plastic trait rather than a default standing disposition. Even in fairly early human environments, there were occasionally some opportunities for beneficial cooperation with strangers. It would be much better if you had a conditional response, so that when threat cues are present, you tend to react hostilely or at least not in a cooperative way without group members. But when the threat cues aren't present, you are able to act in ways that allowed cooperation that was mutually beneficial. Now, over time, the environmental factors shift so that there are more cases where there are possibilities for mutually beneficial cooperation without group members. And at that point, you can't take advantage of them, right? If you're literally hardwired for exclusion, for negative attitudes toward people. So there's good reason to think that it would have been more advantageous to have a conditioned kind of environmentally sensitive response rather than a default standing response of this exclusionary or negative sort. So the good news is that inclusive morality is not hardwired. The bad news is the same resources used for cultural innovations that foster inclusivist morality can be used to dismantle it, triggering exclusivist responses. Now, in the paper, we say a lot about how certain kinds of cultural innovations can expand the circle or enable us to extend moral regard to others that we previously not extended it to. And it runs the gamut from markets, which enable mutually beneficial cooperation with people we don't care about, to little bits of social moral technology like the Golden Rule, which enables you to extend regard to people by putting yourself in their position. There's a whole range of different kinds of cultural innovations that can help extend our regard under the right circumstances, under the right conditions. But the problem is that, all of those rely upon a sort of a tacit folk psychology and a folk social epistemology, and people can often use that knowledge of our psychology and of the way our social practices affect beliefs for just the opposite reasons, that is, to dismantle the gains that we've made. One of my favorite examples is that in Claudia Kunz's book, The Nazi Conscience, she cites a passage from a teacher's manual in the Third Reich for public school teachers. And it says, you're supposed to teach your students not just facts, but also values. And of course, one of the most important is the Golden Rule, with the proviso that it only applies to racial comrades. Right? Now, that's a great example where you have a very inclusivist kind of bit of social moral technology, the thought experiment involving the Golden Rule. But it's being modified in a way that restricts the scope of regard to a certain group and excludes others from the scope of the norm. When we talk about the manipulation of belief to create threat cues to trigger exclusivism, dehumanization, which is well documented, especially in the Holocaust literature, which generates cues of threat parasite, mentioned that before, also physically sequestering members of the other group in an environment that makes them filthy and diseased, reinforces this threat cue, activates it, makes it more potent. And of course, the exaggeration of threat or violence that outgroups pose, standard techniques, exaggeration of the threat that foreign ways pose to one's own group's cohesions and values. I think about Patrick Buchanan's statement a while back, let all these immigrants in, you're going to be hearing bongo drums on Main Street. And then the implication is that the entire social fabric will unravel if you hear bongo drums on Main Street. And exaggerating the problem of scarcity and prevalence of zero-sum situations. There's a literature about the origins of World War II that's quite illuminating here. It looks like that a lot of the leaders and some of the population of the fascist countries and Japanese militarists really bought into a kind of nationalist version of social Darwinism and thought that international relations was just a bloody conflict to the death, and that countries had to compete over scarce resources to survive, and that they combined that with this doctrine of economic autarky that said that you had to actually control within your jurisdiction all the resources you needed for your economy. And the result of this is a moral psychology of other nations, which attributes to them, you know, that they're basically a threat, an existential threat. And if enough people believe that and act in that way, then you get a great impetus toward preventive wars. And an abandoning of the few international institutions like the League of Nations, which actually provided for some possibility for peaceful cooperation among nations. And then, you know, once you've undermined those, it's again sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. Countries have to rely more on their own might to get along. Now, the cognitive biases that seem to be operating in some of this cultural manipulation to invoke threat cues, there's a wonderful book by Hirschfeld called Race in the Making, and also a paper by Sarah Jane Leslie, which I think is very important here. Hirschfeld argues that cross-culturally, children at a very early age have a kind of tendency toward a natural kindness essentializing ontology. They tend to divide human beings that they encounter or even hear about into different groups, and to assume that all the members of the group share a common hidden essence that's very strongly deterministic of the behavior of members of the group. Mary Jane Leslie points out in our empirical literature that indicates that also cross-culturally, there's a very disturbing tendency for people if they observe or think they observe threatening behavior in one member of another group, they tend to attribute that behavior to all members of the group. And it doesn't work in the other direction. If you observe friendly behavior, you don't tend to overgeneralize that. It's an asymmetrical attribution error. And there's, in terms of evolutionary risk management theory, there's a reason why you'd expect that asymmetry in the environment of ancestral adaptation, because in that environment, if you encounter a stranger, you need to make two mistakes. They're quite different. One is to be overly trusting, and the other is to not be trusting enough, that is to forego a genuine opportunity for mutually beneficial cooperation. And because there's so few social infrastructures for mutually beneficial cooperation, and because the threats posed by parasites and competition for scarce resources are so great, the downside of making one error is much greater than the downside of making the other. So you expect there to be selection for people who are biased toward one kind of error. So the bottom line is that evolved psychological mechanisms that contribute to exclusive moral responses can be triggered by the manipulation of belief through the exploitation of defective social epistemic practices, including misplaced epistemic deference. That is, the Nazi mobilizers of violence were very good at this. They always co-opted people who were people who occupied positions of epistemic authority in the society they were working in. And all of this helps explain regression using the same explanatory model that explains progress. And that's an advantage of our account, I think. So what's the role of culture? Well, cultural innovations can foster environments that are favorable to inclusive plurality by actually mitigating the features of the EEA that are favorable to exclusive plurality and that penalize inclusive plurality. Things like reducing scarcity, raising productivity enough that it's not dangerously costly to extend surpluses to other people, providing infrastructures for peaceful cooperation among groups, all those things, thereby creating conditions in which the capacity for open-ended normativity, this kind of critical reasoning about your norms and your ideas of moral status, can develop in this direction. So what are some of the advances? Advances in food production that reduce severe competition for resources, medical, nutritional, and public health innovations that reduce the burden of infectious disease, development of institutional infrastructures that enable peaceful, mutually beneficial interactions between groups, security arrangements that reduce the violence between groups, including institutions of punishment that replace vendettas. And what are some of the cultural innovations that then, after these other innovations have created a space for inclusivity, what are some of the innovations that actually move us to occupy that space? Well, think about how some Christians, especially initially Quakers, reinterpreted an existing cultural resource, namely their idea of Christianity, reinterpreted it so that they thought it was incompatible with slavery and with tolerance of slavery. That was a huge move in the direction of inclusion to extend basic natural rights to African slaves. Think about how the abolitionists appealed to both emotions and the reasons to change perceptions of the moral status of African slaves, combating false beliefs about natural differences between blacks and whites, and the blacks don't have sufficient reason to have natural rights, and also don't suffer in the way that whites do. And similarly, with respect to non-human animals, think about the techniques of the animal liberation people. On the one hand, they make us aware of the terrible practices we engage in and inflict suffering on animals. They tell us about the comparative anatomy of pain and that try to convince us that animals really can suffer in the way that we can. And then there's also the idea of developing better moral consistency reasoning. An interesting paper by Campbell, his first name, I can't remember, Victor Kumar, on moral consistency reasoning, which is a form of what we call open-ended normativity. All of these things are cultural innovations, and they can't occur just anywhere, and they can't become pervasive and socially potent just anywhere. That's the point. You have to think about the conditions under which they're likely to do that. So how do you facilitate moral progress and prevent regression? Well, here's a list of kind of things that are obvious in a way. It's just that we're looking at them in a different way. We're seeing them as fitting into a patterned explanation of how moral progress occurs and how there can be regression. Alleviate the harsh conditions of the EEA where they still exist. And the harsh conditions don't just exist in failed states or extremely poor countries. They exist in microenvironments within developed societies. Some urban environments, for example. You try to avoid regressions to EEA-like conditions. In particular, you try to prevent those who mobilize exclusivist moral responses by exploiting social and systemic resources to dismantle the cultural innovations that have fostered inclusivity. And you try to combat the normal cognitive biases and social and systemic practices that hinder inclusivity. A bit more concretely, reduce the incidence of infectious disease, increase physical security, foster economic development to increase social surpluses, easing economic competition in groups, create institutions to extend peaceful, mutually beneficial cooperation among groups, develop better social epistemic practices. Now note, all of those things could be done without explicitly appealing to the idea of moral progress, and we're already trying to do some of them without any idea that they're connected to moral progress. And this raises an interesting question. Do we do better if we articulate and get some social consensus on an idea of moral progress and on a theory of conditions under which it can occur, and then, as it were, explicitly and directly try to pursue moral progress? Or is it better if we do it sort of implicitly and indirectly? In the past, the explicit efforts to pursue moral progress at the social level have been disastrous. In many cases. Not in all cases, but in many cases. So, important to remember that nothing we say in this paper says, here are society's marching orders, and there are people who know what moral progress is, namely us, and people like us should be given authority to try to achieve moral progress. Nothing about that follows whatsoever. There's not a whiff of that in the paper. Although one of the people who reviewed the paper attributed all of that to us. Marvel, I think. So one of the things that the theory of moral progress have to address is how can you best achieve moral progress in a morally acceptable way? And then the other question is, shouldn't your theory of moral progress include an idea about how we can make progress in our conception of moral progress? So I'll leave it with that. Thank you. I take it all back. Okay. Poverty, physical insecurity, and war zones, burden infectious disease do not just cause death and suffering. That's bad enough, right? That's the main problem. They also prevent people from attaining the moral excellence that human beings are capable of. I mean, some people can attain the highest moral excellence in the worst conditions, but it's certainly a handicap for many people to attain moral excellence, if that includes this sort of inclusivist outlook, right? If they're in these terribly harsh conditions. So there's an additional injury to people who are in the conditions, basically the conditions of the environment of evolutionary adaptation. It's not just that they're suffering and they're poor and they're insecure and they're subject to infectious diseases. It's that because of all that, it's much less likely that they and the people around them are going to be developing morally progressive outlooks on life. And that's an additional problem. Okay.
Encores. These are encores.
Okay, yeah, this is the encore. Here's what we've done. We've begun to develop a naturalistic theory of moral progress that avoids the lack of empirical grounding of previous theories, steers clear of parochial racist ideas, avoids the progress is inevitable iron laws view, explains why one form of moral progress is so difficult and so incomplete in its penetrance, and explains stalling and regression. That's really it.
Okay, so we're going to have a short response now from Guy Cahane, and after he's given his response, we'll open up the floor to general questions.
It's a pleasure to comment after a fascinating paper, the kind of ethics on a kind of world historical scale that we don't often see, and it would be nice to have more of that. I'm going to offer kind of pretty scattered comments, and we'll see how many of them I'll manage to cover in the 15 minutes or less. So just quickly review what Allen and Russell are trying to do in a very ambitious paper. They remind us about this notion of moral progress that's unduly neglected. In the paper, they sketch what a more ambitious account of moral progress would be. One that would actually defend the standards for moral progress that are used to assess human history, both as substantive and ethical. But they're doing something a bit less ambitious, they're kind of assuming certain kind of liberal, inclusive moral standards, and they try to offer a naturalistic account of how moral progress has been achieved so far and how it's possible to achieve it in the future, and they emphasize the need for naturalistic theory of such moral progress. They make the point that there has been significant moral progress so far, especially with respect to inclusivity, but also in other ways. And they want to argue that there can be at least potentially further moral progress in the future, and that Barr's ever conservative claims about limits to moral progress or inclusive morality are false or overstated. And that evolutionary theory in moral psychology and social moral epistemology can help us identify factors that could inhibit further moral progress. So, what I'm going to try to do, so probably what I mostly want to do is say a bit more about this idea of moral progress. So what I'm saying here is not really critical, but I think the idea is there's more to be said about it, and an ambitious theory of moral progress is not really one that would give a substantive meta-ethical defense of our standard. There's quite a bit of other work to be done at a purely conceptual, philosophical level before we even get to the naturalistic explanation question. And if there's some time, I'll say some vaguely critical remarks about the kind of naturalistic story that Allen sketched for us. We'll see how much of that I managed to get through. In one sense, the idea of moral progress is probably straightforward. It's human history, and if there is moral progress, at some point we were worse, and over time we're getting better. It doesn't need to be a story of continuous progress without setbacks, but on the whole, we have some evaluative standards, some account of what makes things morally better or worse, and we then look at history and see whether things are getting better or worse in this respect. We're applying this evaluative standard to events over time. There's a question of where we get this standard from, and essentially the more ambitious kind of account of moral progress that Allen will describe you would need to address what we can call a Rawlsian challenge. We talk about moral progress in the sense of a kind of Whiggish narrative. That's interpreting history from our present liberal perspective, which is such a contingent standpoint, it cannot really be given an external justification. And in principle, I agree this challenge needs to be met, but probably there's not as much to say on this as we may wish. But I think I agree with Allen that it's entirely legitimate to set it aside when look in this notion of moral progress. And anyway, if we need to justify our present moral beliefs, we'll need to do it independently of any theory of moral progress. So it's not clear that this major, major ethical substantive defense of our moral beliefs is really that fundamental to an account of moral progress. Another kind of maybe more direct way about this idea of just assuming our current moral beliefs in looking back at history or looking at the future, that moral progress in the past has obviously involved very radical changes in moral belief. And we obviously can't assume that we've always arrived at moral truth, even more so if we're arguing that future moral progress is possible or likely. And obviously, future moral progress, it's a bit optimistic thing, it's just going to be our minority beliefs getting more widely accepted and implemented. So I think that that's kind of a reason for some qualification of just assuming our current moral beliefs and talking about moral progress, but remains the case that we can't help but interpret things from our best current moral framework. So it's a worry we need to be aware of and self-conscious of, but there's not much we can do about it. It still remains the case, it's quite hard to answer the question about the future feasibility of forwarding moral progress without having some sense of the end point. And there's kind of a slight word that Allen and Russell are never stated explicitly, but I assume a pretty conservative, liberal view of morality and politics. And you can think of very more radical, moral accounted, take inclusivity much farther, whether utilitarian or Marxist or various radical postmodern utopian vision. But it's a question about feasibility and the future take very different forms depending on what's supposed to be this end point. Anyway, so suppose we assume our moral, current moral framework and we kind of look at history and try to say whether things are getting better or worse. I think this notion that we can evaluate things in this way is actually a lot less straightforward than maybe implied by some of the things that Ellen said. What do we mean when we say that things are getting morally better? We can mean that they're getting better morally speaking, that is, that there's more well-being, less suffering if you're utilitarian. When we talk about moral progress, we usually talk, I think, about something like this. We're getting morally better. The first thing to notice, these things, they may or we may want them to go together, but they don't have to. In principle, they can come apart. Things may be getting morally better, maybe get better morally speaking, all kind of important ways while we're getting morally worse. Or you may imagine things getting morally better, but things are getting worse morally speaking. So these two things may be causally related, but they don't have to always go together. This notion of things getting morally better, what do we mean by that? Is it an epistemic idea or a doxastic idea of getting better moral ideas or concept or conception that comes up quite a bit in what Ellen said? Or is it about various small acts and practices, so we are doing better things or less wrong things, whether at individual level or institutional level, or maybe people are getting morally better or more virtuous. And then you can talk about the world containing less or more injustice, equality, etc. Of course, on some view, you can also include that under this heading. And again, all of these things can come apart in all kind of complex ways. So, without my inclined to think that we are generally getting better moral beliefs, and our institutions are morally better and more just, but that human individuals in certain ways are less virtuous than they were in the past, then these things can come apart in all kind of ways. So we said things are getting morally better, all sorts of variables that we could be assessing events by. And we shouldn't assume they all kind of, it's straightforwardly clear what we're talking about and how they all hang together.
Excuse me, I better grab my things so I can write some things down when you're talking. Or something.
Is this the water that I'm allowed to drink from? Okay. So there are all these things that we could be measuring when we say things are getting morally better, or that we are getting morally better, but it's quite hard to see how to add them up. That's only a challenge. I'm not aware of any significant systematic account of. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Even if you just consider each of these elements, how do we add up them up together? So are we just measuring how many correct moral beliefs are at time t and then at time t1? Obviously, some moral beliefs are more important than others. Are the general moral beliefs more significant? Particular moral beliefs more significant? Maybe some beliefs are half true or partly true. How do we weigh all tapping with some error and we say our moral beliefs have been getting better? the same for more lakhs. So we're just going to count how many more lakhs at prehistorical times are happening and how many wrong acts are happening today. Some are more lakhs more significant than others. How do we weigh all of that in some measure of things getting better? Again, focus at institution level or at individual level. And the same pretty much for all of these things. There are many things we could be looking at. Do we include superrogatory acts? Are they less or more important? And so there's this question of how to aggregate more stuff that's not at all obvious. We just look at some total kind of number, or we're going to look at some average improvement. So some ways in which Steven Pinker's account of law progress kind of almost unthinkingly assumes an average kind of notion, which got him into some trouble ignoring numbers. Or you may give some weight to distribution. Maybe the very best small beliefs should get some special weight, or maybe the very worst small beliefs in a population or world should get a special weight. So there are lots of ways in which you could try to add them, and it's not at all obvious how to do it. And then we should presumably, if we want to get some overall measure of how good or bad things are, morally speaking, we need to add up these different elements in some way. And again, it's not at all obvious. Should we give more weight to improvements in moral beliefs, or more weight to acting rightly or wrongly, to institutional injustice or justice, etc.? It's just not at all obvious how we can end up. So a lot of people are skeptical about the value of how measuring how better or worse the world is, just morally speaking. I suspect there'll be a lot more skepticism about the idea of kind of aggregating moral, how good or bad we are morally, from a more, I'm just using the this idea that we can look at how better or worse we are morally in this kind of aggregate total overall ways is going to be quite a bit of skepticism. Also, of course, even if we deal with all these conceptual problems, there's quite a bit of descriptive issues about how to actually measure that in the real world. It's not as if we have counts of how many correct moral beliefs people have or how many wrong acts go on out there. So it's quite a bit more complicated, it may seem kind of first intuitive, impressionistic level. Another question that kind of came up, there was a distinction you drew at some point, it was close to a distinction I would like to draw now, but I think it's not the same thing, and I think this distinction is actually pretty important and also touches on this issue of a naturalistic account. Because what I described so far is how we measure how good things are, morally speaking, or how morally good things are at some point in time, and moral progress implies that they're getting better overall. But you can also, by moral progress, refer to the process by which this happens. And that question about how that occurs. And even if you thought that from our current point of view, things have been getting morally better, it's a further question whether it's happening because that will be better, or whether this progress occurs for the right moral reason. It's a bit similar to the distinction you made between people just acting better without actually improving their moral conception. But that's not the same thing, because of course our moral conceptions or beliefs can also get more and more correct, but because of our external forces, not because they are true. And I was kind of surprised you didn't mention, at least in passing, various whether conservative or radical left historical explanations of various instances of moral progress or greater inclusivity, morality, and there are quite strong accounts of that time. They may or may not be the whole story, and they may not be even part of the story. But these would be accounts of how we get to have the beliefs we have over time, or how practices change in a way that, from our present point of view, looks like an improvement. But just to begin, obviously, and it's something you alluded to, I think if it's all happening for various extrinsic reasons, that would be quite a bit less good. So more progress would be a less valuable thing if it was happening because of these external forces, even if it was validated. And, but let's just return to this issue of the evaluative standard we're using. If it all turns out that where we are now and how we are evaluating things We've arrived at that through some process where all of these extrinsic forces that actually have nothing to do with the truth of those ideas were pushing us to, then we'll need to revisit the question of whether this standard we're applying really has the status we assume it has. And in a way, to get to the naturalism issue, maybe the challenge here is to do that in a way that respects a naturalistic frame. And I think it's a considerable challenge. Now, that probably gets us into some of the meta-ethical stuff, especially if you understand morality in some broadly non-naturalistic terms in terms of its content. I see that I've mixed up some slides this morning. Well, it's just a copy of the same. Okay, I'm just going. What's happened when you prepare slides early in the morning? They all got mixed up here. Anyway, sorry for that. Do I have a few more minutes? I'll just go through the first half of the presentation. I think it's more interesting. Kind of jump ahead now. I need to reverse this. So apologies for that. I just draw attention to this idea of how we measure moral progress over time. So we're comparing, we're claiming that things are morally better time t than they were in some time t minus one, and claiming it might get better in time t plus one. But again, another problem of that comparing things across time is to begin with, there's different, very dramatic difference in population size, which generates all kinds of problems. Alluded to some of them when I talk about aggregation. We're looking just at averages, then population doesn't matter. If you're counting how many bad acts are done, then in some ways over the average, we are on an average level morally better, but there's a lot more total moral badness in the world. You'll get very different accounts of whether there's overall moral progress depending on what stand you take on this. Population size also affects the kind of things we can do and what kind of causal difference we can make. And how much better and wrong we do, and in combination with technological advances, can affect. We might be in some ways better compared to the things that past people could do, but we can do, and we do all the bad stuff of not doing all kind of very important good stuff. So in that sense, we might be getting far and far worse, even if our moral beliefs in various ways are improving. One thing that also I thought was in the background of some of the things you said, but would be, I think, quite important in comparing times is that there are very dramatic changes in non-moral knowledge. And a lot of things that looks like moral advances, and you describe something to do with, for example, slavery, maybe just advances in empirical belief rather than significant change in moral belief, and distinguishing the two is not always straightforward. And again, because we now know lots more stuff, certainly non-moral level, but possibly at the moral level, it may be that we are better doxastically, but also we are much more blameworthy, and a lot of stuff we do is worse. So again, we can be getting better in all kinds of ways, and at some impressionistic level, we want to say there have been a lot of moral progress, but it doesn't automatically follow that overall things have been getting better from this moral point of view. So I think, and that's kind of seemed like the line, that it's a distinction that you don't explicitly draw, but if you just mean that by our present life, things have improved in some important respects over the last thousands of years or over the last few hundred years, then nobody could seriously deny that. But that's kind of obvious. If you want to say that things have improved, morally improved overall, I hope I've shown that that's not at all as obvious as it may seem at first sight. Probably true. But it's actually quite a difficult question, and you need to answer all of the kind of issue that I've kind of concerned I've tried to raise. Just in kind of example, that's kind of a good analogy, I think. I've seen always Athens was morally better than this kind of almost quasi-fascist Sparta, but it was more enlightened in all kind of important way. They had various practices that may have been far superior to the Spartan, but overall were they morally better? I mean, they did some pretty terrible stuff. So I think the question of whether we are overall morally better, whether the overall moral progress in that sense is quite an open and difficult one. And there's a lot of conceptual work to be done on spelling out what we mean before we can mean by moral progress before we can answer that. So I think some of the kind of complication I've tried to raise, maybe another reason why people have ignored this notion of moral progress. I still think it's pretty astonishing at all. We have these pretty sophisticated measures of large-scale economic factors, and even some measures of happiness or well-being more recently. This, at least to my knowledge, has not been any serious attempt to develop powerful measures of morality, which is essentially what you need to have a not merely impressionistic account that, that things are getting morally better. Why is that? One speculation that we'd probably prefer not to know just how bad we are, but it is a strange omission that is kind of pretty hard to explain. Probably, I don't know, how long? I can go on, okay. So I'll I have really no sense of when I'm supposed to stop, so you should signal to me if I'm...
Okay, I'll let you.
So just really, this was really supplemental, so the other, I think at least one can think about pardon. I think an ambitious theory of moral progress would address these issues rather than this major ethical substantive one, which, as I said, I think are completely independent. So there's this conceptual work to be done. And I'm just turning to this quite different, in some way more modest, but still very ambitious empirical issues. So one thing Ellen was discussing was this ever-conservative challenge. Now, I found it hard to see the challenge, but I can see that there's some point in addressing this claim, but they seem incredibly weak and quite hard to understand. So does anybody really seriously deny that some advances have been made in this inclusivist direction? In the paper you mentioned Fukuyama, which I saw you omitted from the PowerPoint, but he's in a way way over optimistic about what at least in 89.
Yeah,
so it's quite hard to see who could deny it. I mean, I suppose John Gray seems to deny that there's any more progress, but I don't think it raises any kind of serious philosophical challenge, maybe a challenge for our patients. Oops. Again, the claim that there can't be any further moral progress or increasing inclusivity or that these things are not durable. Given that we've changed so much since the Lepus Savannah, how can any kind of purely evolutionary consideration show those things? It's
completely,
doesn't make any sense. I mean, you can appeal, I just don't know what these people are saying. Of course, you can appeal to the claim it's hard to abolish the family or private property, but this is based on people trying that, not on anything to do with evolution. Claim communism incompatible with human, again, some tiny bit of evidence for that, but people who say that as some robust empirical claim, just ridiculous, I would say. And finally, we don't need evolutionary psychology on too much of that to know that humans have very strong tendencies to think in very groupish ways, so to speak. So again, I think, as I said, that's not a serious point of contention by anyone. So it's hard to see what this ever-conservative challenge really is. Skip that. So one where I had, and I'm kind of slightly overstating the point, and I wasn't sure how much really what evolutionary psychology does in helping us build a naturalistic theory of moral progress. It's just wondering how much work it's really doing. And then a lot of the work seems to be done by various aspects about our psychology. And that's something we need to get evidence for directly. Right. All of these claims are in-group, out-group biases or cognitive biases. Evolutionary psychology can suggest some hypotheses about that stuff, but they need to be confirmed, and it's useful at that level. Or once we know that our psychology has a certain shape, it may sometimes explain why, which would be useful as a kind of complete account, and it would be good to know. But beyond that, it doesn't do a great deal of work. And of course, there's this familiar point that's still worth always returning to, that the fact that you can tell some adaptive story for why we have some psychological disposition, it sounds kind of plausible. That's still quite far from showing that that's where we got it from. Like I said, that's kind of some small piece of the puzzle, but doesn't seem like the most important one. And so having said that, does the evolutionary psychology story tell us something we didn't know independently about our psychology? I'm a bit oversimplifying or overstating the point, but it doesn't seem like it's really adding much. So I would say that the point about pathogens is something that we probably wouldn't have thought of independently. Of course, we all know that racist discourse appeals to various forms of disgust and pathogens in like discourse or vocabulary, but that's kind of familiar. It helps explain that. It would be more interesting if the threat of infectious disease would have some effect on in-group, out-group processes in some. Maybe I don't know something that you do, but well, think about AIDS, for example. Did that significantly affect or increase inclusivist morality in the 85s? There may be empirical stuff that you know that I don't know, but I kind of wonder whether that factor, which would be a surprising, interesting discovery, really has that much causal significance. Of course, in some extreme cases of epidemics, you would expect those processes to occur, but that's kind of, again, something we would know anyway. So the real work, I think, is done by the psychological claims. And here again, I'm maybe a bit overstating the case. Kind of wonder whether we are learning something that's kind of not familiar from, I think, in the paper you mentioned, this huge literature of explaining racism, nationalism, etc., especially since World War II onwards. A huge literature in social science and history. But you know, I learned in high school, I think, in times of economic crisis, people are more racist, and it's harder to be nice, morally speaking, in conditions of scarcity and threat. So it's kind of, I think I'm stating it as a kind of challenge, a bit overstating a challenge, but it's not terribly clear that the payoff is that great. It's kind of a spelling out of some of the details in an important way, but not clear more than that. But again, it's not clear how much all of that kind of background factor really does to explain some recent historical phenomena relating to war progress or regress, whether it's nationalism. I don't think it plays more than a partial, possibly small background role in the story, or evolving a rise in human rights practices, etc. So evolutionary theory plays some constraint on psychology, and psychology plays some important constraint on what we should do when we make explanations. Sociology and history, but it seems to me that an account of more, probably needs to be a naturalistic account, in the sense it doesn't appear to all kind of supernatural stuff or strange power of reason. And really, the real work is really done at this sociological, historical level. Analytic philosophers don't like these two disciplines or words too much, so they steer away from it. But that's really, I think, where the work will need to be done. And I mean more than, of course, you mentioned social moral epistemology, which is an interesting part of the struggle. I think it will need to be quite a bit more than that. And I suppose that partly depends on what causal force you think moral belief has in history. I would see it as having some pretty mild force, or something that's driven by other things rather than driving things. And then if you go to the historical, which said there's this word that a lot of these inclusivist trends in recent history really can be explained in other extreme ways. And like I said, there are accounts that sort of try to explain the great emphasis on individual rights and freedom about various interests of the global market economy, etc., etc. Now, I'm not saying these are correct, but these are kind of challenges you need to address at that level. So I think the interesting work, like I said, is done by this psychology in group and out, especially when you're interested in advances in inclusivist morality, it's going to be done by the level of psychology, not clearly by evolutionary theory. And we know lots of this stuff. I think from my familiarity with this literature, of course, again, some people you may be in position to correct me, but from speaking to some leading figures in that literature, this is one area where a lot of the kind of interesting question about advances in our inclusivist moral thinking haven't been directly addressed well, because it's one literature that has not really been connected to moral philosophy and other areas of moral psychology. And I think that's kind of one place where if you want to give a naturalistic kind of increase rise in more inclusivist accounts of morality, where you need to do some more ambitious empirical work. rather than the evolutionary story, which is very, very distant. So just to give some example, a lot of that work in literature is really about patterns of behavior, attitude. There's very little, so far as I know, there are some exceptions where people directly look and study the psychological structure underlying explicit thinking about forms of partiality that are justified or not, or what makes people more impartial, adopt more impartial moral views, rather than just favored. You have all kinds of influence, but you may judge that it's more wrong to that some anchor by an out-group member is more wrong, and you will be exhibiting some in-group bias when you do that. But that doesn't mean that you will endorse that as an explicit moral view. That's an area where I think a lot of that psychological literature hasn't really made enough progress. So one key question I think would be quite relevant going back to the evolutionary stuff is whether the development of more inclusivist way of moral thinking really involve overcoming group thinking, which sometimes sounds like what you have in mind, or whether it just involves extending what one takes to be one's group. And that would put a quite different direction if you're trying to promote broader inclusivist morality. And there's some empirical work that actually suggests that you can increase more inclusive notions of morality by expanding your notion of what a group is rather than by overcoming this idea of group morality. Just kind of as a kind of starting point, going back again to the evolutionary stuff, it actually seems that this more expansion is kind of rigidly hierarchical, self-effacing, leader-oriented, extreme exclusivist morality of more recent times. You mentioned National Socialism. Really have the roots not in this hunter-gatherer psychological disposition that you focus on, but in this more quite different set of this psychological disposition and social structure that are characteristics of farming societies of the post-agricultural revolution. Some people want to actually state that it's more egalitarian, inclusive view that we are you see as more progress, or really a way of going back to this hunter-gatherer societies, of course, in many ways much more egalitarian than farmer societies. Of course, it's all happening inside the in-group, but if egalitarian liberal thinking is just a way of expanding the group, that's entirely compatible with thinking, but really returning to where we started rather than transcending it in some dramatic way, which can sound like the kind of account that you're getting. Anyway, I've went on far longer than I should have. You should have stopped me, but that's okay. Thank you.
For just like 5 minutes, is that okay? Thank you. I mean, I agree with virtually everything you said. Let me just try to make a couple minor points. At the very beginning, Guy talked about the worry about prematurity in our conception of what moral progress is, and that moral progress might not just be a matter of sort of extending to more people and giving more power to some standards that some of us already have. I think that's right, and that's why at the very end of the talk I said that you need to think about your theory of moral progress as including an account of how we make progress and our conception of moral progress, so that we have to think about a dynamic conception of moral progress. So I agree with that entirely. Now the second point about problematic conservatism, I think you're absolutely right. I think that if you read what we say in the paper and what I said in the presentation, you get the idea that Powell and I think that whatever additional moral progress is going to occur along the dimension of inclusivity, it's not going to require some major shakeup of social institutions. It's going to be more a matter of, you know, eradicating infectious disease, increasing fiscal security, etc. But that might not be true. It might turn out, here's one sort of crude scenario. Suppose it's true that capitalism, as we know it, as we're likely to have it, tends toward increasing social inequality. Inequality that becomes so great that it becomes more and more difficult for people at the very top of the distribution to have appropriate moral responses to people at the lower end. That is, that the difference between the 1% and the rest becomes, in effect, a kind of in-group, out-group difference, so that certain kinds of moral responses are just disabled on the part of the better off, because the social distance
created by the inequality is so extreme. If that's true, and if that's an artifact of capitalism, then it might turn out that there's a real limit to what kind of moral progress can be made along the dimension of inclusivity within the current framework that includes capitalism. I think this is the kind of thing you're talking about. That is, that it might turn out there have to be some much larger structural changes for some forms of moral progress to become possible or for them to extend very far. And I think that's something we have to think about. And you know, what we were working on, you know, a paper which you might have thought should have been written before these two papers, but we couldn't have written it beforehand because we wouldn't have known the questions. But it addresses many of the questions that Guy's raising about prematurity and the need for a dynamic notion about whether moral progress of certain kinds may require fundamental changes beyond the ones that we talk about, and also the measurement problem. You know, we're very careful in this paper not to say anything about progress overall, and I think it's enormously difficult. I mean, the problem is there are different dimensions of moral progress, and there's no reason to think that there's the unity of moral progress in the way some people think there's a unity of virtues. It might turn out that in the real world, advances in one dimension are almost always going to be accompanied by regressions in other dimensions, that all good things don't go together. And also, when you look at the distribution across populations, that the penetrance of some particular form of progress is going to be wider in one area, narrower in another. The idea of making overall assessments, it just may not be possible to make overall assessments. I tend to think it's not possible. But if it's not, then the question is, well, how valuable is the theory of moral progress? And you might say, well, it's okay, because you don't have to think about progress overall, just concentrate on making progress in certain ways. Well, that sounds okay, unless you have the worry that progress in certain dimensions may actually be making things worse in other dimensions. That, one of the reasons you want an overall sort of aggregated notion is to avoid that risk, right? So I think those are just enormously difficult questions. And now the point about how much work evolutionary psychology is doing. I mean, we certainly don't want to make it sound like it's doing most of the work. We identify a number of different pieces of the puzzle, including, things that come out of genocide studies, Holocaust studies, social moral epistemology, other kinds of factors. It might be that we've given too much prominence to evolutionary psychology for a very path-dependent defensive reason. That is, there are people who think you could get enormous mileage out of evolutionary psychology. And some of them have thought that the mileage that you get includes a very pessimistic view about the possibility of certain forms of moral progress. So it might be we've given too much attention, too much prominence to the evolutionary psychology component, but we certainly don't think it's the only component or even the main component. I think in some cases it does give you a little additional information that enables you to discern some patterns that you might not see clearly in the other literatures. But I agree with all of that. Also, this question about whether you get more inclusiveness by overcoming groupish moral responses or by just extending your identification of the group, including everybody in the group, I think, again, that's a fundamental question. And I think that in some of the greatest historical examples of moral progress, it's been the latter. That is, take the case of abolition. You come to regard African slaves as being part of the population that has sufficient reason to have natural rights, and hence not to be proper subjects of being enslaved. I was very happy to hear you say that, in effect, that there's no special problem about moral objectivity in the case of moral progress, and that the sort of rorty worry is a generalized worry. And I think we need to be clearer about that to be properly self-defensive. Okay, one last. Yeah, I mean, I think part of the work that needs to get done is to think about a naturalistic account of how we come to have ideas of moral progress, and of which of them are more appropriate, and of how there can be progress in our conceptions of moral progress, and in particular of how conceptions of moral progress can become less parochial or culturally biased. Well, that's, I mean, you know, I can't say more because I agree basically with everything you said.